Amazon Prime Day is coming, and it's so special, we brought out the confetti cannons. What's Prime Day? It's a day with more deals than Black Friday, exclusively for Amazon Prime members. Amazon Prime members can save big on thousands of amazing items, all on Prime Day. Not a Prime member? There's still time to sign up. Go to Amazon.com right now. Don't miss it. Prime Day is one day only, July 15th. I'm going to need a lot more confetti, so you know.
Blog Talk Radio.
Your host tonight is the eating disorder pro, Dr. J. Renee Norton. She comes to you live from Cincinnati, Ohio, home of the Bengals, the Reds, and of course, the Norton Center for Eating Disorders. If you or a loved one is struggling with obesity, anorexia, bulimia, emotional eating, or if you're just worried about food pollution, then you'll want to unhook and tune in.
Good evening and welcome to the Eating Disorder Pro Show. I'm Dr. Renee Norton and I'll be your host this evening. Tonight is part three of a four-part series entitled The Sunshine Diet. The first episode focused on what cholesterol is, and last week's episode focused on cholesterol sulfate and vitamin D sulfate and their importance in our overall health. We also talked about how they can only be made when the sun shines on our skin. I shared the results of a test called an EndoPAP with you last week, and the extraordinary change in my vascular efficiency as a result of sitting out in the sun or using a UVB lamp for a few minutes every day. This evening, we have the great fortune of having a representative from the company, Dr. Stephen Lamb, with us to explain the EndoPAP test. And of course, we are going to end the series next week with Dr. Stephanie Senef, and she's going to explain the research that I have been talking about for the past several weeks. So this evening, we have Dr. Stephen Lamb. Dr. Lamb, thank you so much for being with us, and welcome.
Now, you're welcome. Now, one, I wanted to let you know, I'm not a representative of the company, but I have used the EndoPAP for many, many years. So just to clarify.
I didn't realize that. You know what? I actually thought that you worked for the company.
No, I'm a director of Men's Health for New York University, a professor of medicine.
Okay. You know what? I don't have a bio on you. And could you just give us a brief description of your work and your, since I thought you were with a company, I didn't really ask for one.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
I don't work for the company. I'm a professor of medicine at New York University. I'm the director of the Robert Preston Tisch Center for Men's Health at NYU.
Awesome. Okay. So of course you would be using, so how long have you been using the EndoPAP?
Well, I've been using the EndoPAP for many years now, probably 5 or 6 years, and I think it's really a very unique piece of equipment and a unique opportunity to evaluate a variety of different patients with different medical issues. Mm-hmm. It was originally really designed to evaluate heart issues, and I think that when you're dealing with patients with heart issues, you think in terms of prevention, you think in terms of early diagnosis, and then you look in terms of optimum management. So I think that for all of those three areas, there may be an important role for the EndoPAP. But I think that over time, we're starting to appreciate that what the EndoPAP does is, it, in a very non-invasive, simple way, it looks at the lining of the blood vessels called the endothelial cells, which are critically important for healthy blood vessel function. And you have to understand that healthy blood vessels are important for a lot of things, not only for cardiovascular disease, but for migraine sufferers, for patients with sexual dysfunction. So this test may have very broad applicability.
Absolutely. So what do you think about the results that I got? I went from a 1.48 to a 3.04 in 8 weeks.
I mean, I think that the 1.48 is a low score because, you know, less than 1.67 is viewed as having some risk for heart disease. Now, in medicine, you have to be very careful to look at any single value, and looking at a value in the absence of, you know, some knowledge. So you'd want to know that that first test was done in a good setting. That is, was it done in the morning? Was it done without breakfast? Was it done after you've had a normal sleep? Was it, you know, sort of in normal circumstances? And was it actually mm-hmm. done properly? Which I think is important. So 1.8, you know, can I assume you're a healthy woman and that you're otherwise well, not a smoker, you don't have hypertension or anything like that?
Don't have hypertension, but I did have high LDLs, which also, by the way, in that 8-week period went down by half. So
well,
Do you have a family history? Go ahead.
Family history of heart disease or anything like that?
No, but I have markers for it.
The 1.48, you know, it's clearly a little low, but you know, to go from 1.8 to 3, that is really, really unusual because you know, that's a big jump. To be very honest with you, I find that a little unusual. But I think that the important point is that, you know, when you do the test and if it's done and you're comfortable with its reliability, that you can now do something about it. You can say, look, I need to make some changes in my life. I need to make some lifestyle changes. I need to optimize my diet and nutrition and sleep so that I can affect a change, because I think it has a predictive value over many years.
Those are my questions. I would like to know. So let me just answer your question. Your question was it done under the, basically, I think you were asking, was it done under the same circumstances, my particular test? And the answer to that was yes. It was done at the same, almost exact same time of the morning, within 1 minute, under the exact same circumstances. I got a good night's sleep the night before. My blood pressure was lower the second time, which is another indice that I'm looking at, but not that much lower. The conditions under which I was tested the first and second time, in other words, were identical. I didn't eat. I didn't drink any water before I came. I was well rested. And so the circumstances were very similar. So you would agree with me that assuming the test was done properly, and I believe that it was, I have no reason to think that it wasn't done properly, you would agree with me that that's a pretty unusual finding, yes?
Yes, Terry.
I took steps to have that happen. I did make some changes, and I did use the strategies that I learned in my research to make that happen. So I'm absolutely thrilled that it did. So back to the endopath. How reliable, you were just talking about the reliability, how reliable is the endopath, and more importantly, how predictive is it?
Well, I think as you know from the test itself, you know, there's a skill in doing the test. You know, you have to put the probes on properly. You have to have the right conditions for the patient. So if you have a skilled person who's knowledgeable in performing the test, it should be, you know, quite reliable and quite reproducible. I think that because thousands and thousands of tests have already been done, and there are so many validated trials, you know, one can feel pretty comfortable that the endopath test is a true and good reflection of what it says it is, which is a measure of endothelial function, which we know is a very important marker for cardiovascular disease. I mean, the people who studied endothelial function and nitric oxide won the Nobel Prize in 1997 and 1998. So, I mean, this is a very, very important and very predictable test. I think that, but like all tests, you know, all tests are prone and subject to some error. And, you know, once again, I don't take any single laboratory test in isolation, but I certainly, you know, looked at that initial 1.48 that you mentioned, the same. That's a bit of an indicator that maybe you need to make some changes.
Yes, for sure. I was, and then it did have an impact. I recently had more blood work done the day that I did the second test, and there were, of the 15 indices, 10 of them changed in a positive direction.
Fantastic. Yes. That's what you want. You know, progress is made when progress is measured. So they measured something, and, you know, this, you know, and it made you make some changes. And that's exactly how I think these tests are very valuable. In other words,
right.
You get this test in people who are, for example, asymptomatic, they have no symptoms, and they think that because they feel well, they are well. And I've said many times that wellness is not the absence of illness. And just because you feel well doesn't mean you are well. You weren't well a week before your heart attack or a day before I told
exactly.
you had diabetes. So, yeah.
And I'm a perfect example of that because I had great blood pressure, great HDL, not so great LDL, which was the reason we did the test, but everything else looked great. I mean, on paper, everything looked great except for the LDL. Anyway, enough about me.
The LDL is an important number. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's an important... And also, age of the patient.
Particle size.
All kinds of things are... Right. Yeah, I mean, the difference is what you're looking at in the laboratory, or on an X-ray. I mean, in the laboratory, it's a blood test, right? An X-ray is an anatomical, to see how big the heart looks. What the
right.
MCAT is, it's a physiologic test. It basically looks at how the body is reacting.
It's functional,
sorry?
Right?
Yes.
Would you consider
and that's
it functional?
What makes it
yes.
different.
Yes.
Right. It's a different type of test. And it's something
yes.
that we traditionally don't see in medicine.
Right. Who do you target? Who is a target for the EndoPAC? Because you mentioned that you were using it not just necessarily for people who are having cholesterol issues, for example.
Right. So I think that, first of all, we know that in those patients who definitely do have heart disease, it's a very useful test in helping us guide therapy. Are you giving the patient enough treatment? Is the patient doing enough? Because let's say we know they've had some sort of stent or they've had a heart attack, and they think that just because they're taking a statin that somehow everything is okay and they're ignoring everything else. Well, if you find that their scores are still low, you have a chance to do something about it. Then you have the other group who want to ignore their markers. So, they have an elevated cholesterol, they have hypertension, they are overweight, they have a hot body fat. If you do an EndoPAT on them and you show them that their scores are low, you can say to them, look, it appears as though you are at risk for vascular issues. Maybe you want to make some changes. The person
right.
who has a high cholesterol who says that's not important, this is part of, the medical establishment's craziness about cholesterol. Which is probably true in some ways, but and then you have the group that says, look, I have a family history and I want to make certain that I'm optimizing, everything that I can. So the EndoPAT, can actually be used also in this, the 40-year-old, in the 35-year-old, younger patients who really are interested in optimum wellness and want to see how do you measure their level of wellness. So I do like it in those circumstances.
I do too. I especially like it because it is functional. I mean, that to me just makes
yeah.
so much more sense than a blood test. So when you're looking at, and we will, you can see, the audience can see right now, the PowerPoint, and I have a picture of my before and after EndoPAT results. When you're looking at that, graph, and you see it's very in the first one on the first date you see it's very wide, and then on the second one you see that it's very narrow. What actually is represented? Is that because I know nothing about what that actually means,
sure.
but I'm thinking
sure.
it means how much blood can flow through the arteries, but that's probably not right.
No. That's okay. I can't see what obviously you're showing your audience. However. Let me tell you what you're actually seeing. So let me explain this so it's actually very, very, very clear. So we have a fixed amount of blood, right, in our body. And sometimes
right.
we need to send the blood to our muscles when we exercise. Sometimes we need to send it to our gut when we're eating, right? And sometimes we want the blood to actually fill the coronary arteries, so that you can give actually more blood to the heart itself. So the cells that determine that are the endothelial cells. They figure it out where there is a need, and then they deliver blood to that area, which is brilliant, right? So
right.
what we're looking at is whether or not your body can figure out the right place to deliver blood. And the way it does it is you still have the two sensors. You have these two little devices that you had on your finger. And it, you had a little pulse tracing. You saw the blood, you know, the pressure in both arms, in both fingers, right? And you saw it was pretty even. And then after 5 minutes, they blew up a blood pressure cuff on your, for example, your right arm. And so you had no blood going to your right arm. So after 5 minutes, when you released it, your blood, your those endothelial cells were smart enough to figure out that, oh, my God, the right finger and the right hand needs more blood. And so it shifted blood towards your fingers, and the computer could measure how much more blood went into your right hand, how much vasodilatation, okay, mm-hmm. went into your right hand compared to your left. And uh-huh. that vasodilatation is a result of a gas that's released by those cells called nitric oxide. So what you're seeing is more blood going into the hand that required more blood in the second test. The first
right.
test didn't do such a great
that's
job.
What I,
that's what happened.
Yeah, so that is kind of what I thought then. So I was yeah. close. I obviously didn't explain it very well. But yeah, okay, that does make sense. And that's kind of what it looked like in the picture.
Yeah, you see more blood going into that, into the, you know, following the release of the pressure cuff, more blood is going in there compared to the other arm. And that's what you can actually see.
Uh-huh. Awesome. Okay, that's very cool. So what's the earliest age at which testing would make sense? I mean, do you ever test children?
Well, you see, you know, I'm an internist, you know, and we start seeing patients around age 18. But I think there is a growing realization that vascular disease occurs at a younger and younger age. And we know that these fatty streaks are starting to occur in your blood vessels and your coronary arteries. And certainly with this epidemic of obesity and diabetes that occurs even in young adolescents. I wouldn't be surprised if the pediatricians and the pediatric cardiologists start looking at endothelial function in younger and younger patients. But for me personally, you know, I start in the adult population.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense.
But there's no reason that you couldn't do it. You know, I think you'd have to make certain that, you know, whether or not there were enough standards so that you knew what the appropriate number was for people, you know, for kids who were 10 or 11 years old. You know, I don't know if they have validated numbers for that age group.
Right. Well, I'm seeing 10-year-olds I'm seeing 10-year-olds that are pre-diabetic and with type 2 diabetes, and I'm seeing 16-year-olds with metabolic syndrome. So I think
I wouldn't be surprised for the 16-year-old with metabolic syndrome that they might already start having some endothelial dysfunction. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Yeah.
And it's just the end of the problem is that it takes a long time for it to ultimately get to the point where there's so much injury that you actually get a heart attack or you get decreased flow and, you know, kidney issues and hypertension. So, but I the earlier in life you can intervene in a particularly with a lifestyle change, you're better off.
Right. Now, is there a cutoff age on the other end? Is there a point at which it won't work anymore? It doesn't give you results, or can you use it
That's a great question. I mean, I think that, you know, there comes a point where you're saying to yourself, I mean, I don't know if there would be a lot of value to do this to somebody who's 90 years old, who's alive and functioning, you know. I mean, what kind of changes could I possibly make? But I think that, you know, I see it in that 35 to 75-year-old range that I think it really has the greatest implications.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So according to what I understand from what you've said so far, the test is reliable. You trust its reliability. It has a predictive value. It definitely does correlate. When the score is low, you are at risk, much more at risk than you would be if your score was above the 1.67, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So the ranges, the company gives ranges, and basically anything below 1.67 is at risk, and anything above 2 point is good. And according to a representative of the company, go ahead.
You know, 1.67 to 2, the way I think about it, that it you know, it's no additional risk. Above 2, you probably have some protection.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in all the tests, there were so few that I've ever done that actually went above 3, to tell you the truth. The majority of patients, very...
I'm sorry, that's what Robin, the representative of the company, told me. She said they've rarely seen a test score go above 3.
I've rarely seen
it. So what would you say if I told you that I did that by getting sunshine for 8 weeks?
That I happen to like sunshine.
Hold on. Let me guess, you're a golfer, right?
I like vitamin D, and I think that we probably exaggerated a little bit or a lot, you know, this preoccupation. I think that I don't recommend that people get burnt, obviously, and I think that you certainly don't want people to get burnt before the age of 18, you know, and we know it's excessive sun in burning, you know, associated with photoaging and with, you know, basal cell carcinomas and stuff like that. But everybody needs a little, we're all vitamin D deficient. We need to get some vitamin D.
Yeah, and you can only get it, or you can really only get it the right way when you get some sun on your skin. But the same thing, at the same time, you are also getting cholesterol sulfate, which is what the heart needs to beat. And without the cholesterol sulfate, which you can't get unless the sun is shining on your skin, the heart has to make plaque. I mean, it ends up making plaque as a way of trying to compensate for the fact that you don't have the cholesterol sulfate. I came across a researcher. Her name is Dr. Stephanie Senoff. She'll be on the show next week. And her work was fascinating to me. I decided to put her theory to the test personally after I got my EndoPat results. And in 8 weeks, I dramatically changed the outcome by just getting sun. I live in Cincinnati, Ohio, so we have the worst weather. I think we have the third gloomiest weather in the country. So I had to use a UVB lamp part of the time, and I could sit out in the sun the rest of the time. I have to literally climb out the window onto my roof because I have a shady yard. So, but I could do that, and I did do that. Anyway, 8 weeks of less than a half an hour of sun a day is mostly what I changed. And I did also stop drinking coffee and start drinking green tea, but I've done that before and it really didn't have this kind of an effect, obviously. In any event, I am very excited about Dr. Senoff's work. I feel like she probably saved my life. I want to pass this around so that we can save other people's lives. So I hope that you read my paper and read my book and pass it around as well. But in the meantime, back to the EndoPat. So we talked a little bit about the ranges. How long do you recommend waiting in between tests, typically?
I would say 6 months. I think you can do it. You can certainly do it more often. It's just, you know, a matter of it's a painless test, and you know, but there's a cost associated with it. But I think that you know, 6 months seems pretty reasonable to me, as long as you get patients to make some changes.
Exactly.
No reason you can't do it in 3 to 6 months, but I think 6 months seems reasonable.
And when you, in your practice, are you seeing changes? And what kind of changes are you seeing over a 6 to 12 month period, typically?
Well, I think that I don't see the dramatic changes that you know occurred with yourself. I mean, that's pretty impressive, I would say. It'd be important for you to, you know, to repeat it again and see what the numbers are, you know, while you're continuing whatever interventions you're doing.
I keep repeating it. Absolutely. And as I told you, I just got the results of the blood work back that validate the functional test. So the changes, the rise in my vitamin D, the lowering of homocysteine, and the cutting in half of the LDL cholesterol are all, in 8 weeks. Those are all indicators that what I saw functionally is also represented in terms of my blood.
You're moving in the right direction, which is fantastic. I think that what we really do is, you know, there's a whole host of interventions that we do, from encouraging clearly lifestyle changes to changes in medications or adding some supplements. And we're happy, you know, the first thing we also do is try to determine if you have a really low score, you know, how far we need to go to see whether you are at some risk. And there are other tests that we might do like a calcium scoring test or other things we would do, a stress mm-hmm. echo, or, you know.
Right.
But
sure.
And then we just monitor the patients.
Right, right. So it sounds like you are a fan of the Endopat. Were you an early adopter? I mean, is this, because I had never heard of the test before.
Yeah, I have a tendency to look at the areas of medicine where there are clearly some gaps and where there's a need. And it was clear to me that, we had a need to be able to personalize and stratify risks more specifically than we were currently doing. It wasn't enough that you just take a serum cholesterol or you take this family history. You really need to determine in any single patient what their individual risks are. And that's what you're going to be seeing in the future is, this personalization of medicine. One size doesn't fit all. And,
right.
You have to look at a variety of markers. So you can have the genomic markers, you can have the blood markers, you can do the family history. Then if you can add to them some of these functional tests, such as the Endopat, which is, no radiation, no x-ray, non-invasive, then you're
right.
starting to build, a picture for a particular individual.
Yes, exactly. That is what I so love about the test, the non-invasive, no side effects. It's so easy. It takes 15 minutes. It doesn't feel great when they have the cuff on your arm and it's,
correct.
Including
for those 5 minutes. Right. For
right.
the five-minute
period, but it's not a big deal.
Right.
Yeah, it's awesome. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your being on the show this evening and sharing your perspective. It's really been helpful. I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'm going to send you a copy of my results and
sure.
and also a copy of the paper that I wrote about the results. And I am continuing the research. I'm looking to do some additional trials with some of my own patients. And I hope that you are inspired to encourage your patients to get out in the sun. I'm certainly inspired to continue to promote the idea or get the idea out there. And maybe if you have a chance, you can listen to Dr. Senna's show. She'll be on the week after you. So I would love to know if you would like to give me feedback on her theories or you can research them yourself. It's Stephanie Senna. I'd love to know what you think. And hopefully this helps other people.
Cool. Thank you. I very much appreciate this opportunity. I wish you the best.
Thank you so much. Take care and good evening.
You do well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, everybody. So that was Dr. Stephen Lamb, and he gave us some really good information on the Endopat. I found it to be very helpful. I also found it to be very validating. Don't know if you noticed, but he said it was really unusual to get a test result like that. I don't know if I convinced him that we did the test right, but I hope I did. And I hope I am convincing you that getting out in the sun could literally save your life. I cannot wait to have Dr. Stephanie Seneff on next week. Please stay tuned. I have a bunch of questions for her, and we've gotten some of your questions. The rest of you, if you haven't sent your questions in, let's hear them. We'll do the